Welcome to the Mike Fave Podcast. I'm your host, Ethan Wright, joined by Mike Fave. On this podcast, Mike and I help you make sense of the online health chaos while answering your individual health questions along the way. So if you have any health trends, topics, or questions you'd like to see us cover, please leave them in the comments below, and we'd be happy to get them answered on future episodes. In today's episode, we are going to dive into how the carnivore diet causes oxalate dumping and discuss the limits of Sally Norton and Dr. Anthony Chafee's understanding on this. Dr. Paul Saladino's very interesting question to Sally Norton about oxalate metabolism and what you can do if you're having oxalate problems or dumping. All right, Mike, you ready to jump into oxalates?
Yes, let's jump into oxalates. So before we get started, I think it's important to put a caveat here that we're not, or I'm not, but neither you or I think are supporting a pro-oxalate camp. So this is not like pro-oxalate versus anti-oxalate camp. There's some components inside the oxalate theory that I think don't fully make sense to me. Like, they're not 100% dialed in. There's some things, there's some like logical gaps that I want to understand better. So I think that's what I want to talk about today in this episode. I want to get into particularly around like oxalate dumping and endogenous metabolism, or your body's production of oxalates, because there's a lot of focus around oxalates coming in from the diets. Like, people know at this point, we're not going to have spinach. We're not going to do rhubarb or beets or too much cocoa powder or stuff like this. They're high in oxalates, all this type of stuff. But then the question is, and if you have a circumstance where you have somebody who's not eating a lot of oxalates, why are they having oxalate dumping or oxalate problems? And so I want to get into that. And also we'll talk about how like polyunsaturated fats play into this and how metabolic dysfunction directly plays in this. So this is a new angle, I think, on the oxalate camp that may be helpful overall and can kind of explain some of the weird symptoms that I think people get when they go on carnivore diet or a low carb diet and they start to get some of these oxalate symptoms. And so with that, or I agree, especially that like high oxalate foods can be a problem, especially people who are susceptible to them, especially people who have specific issues with oxalates. So if you're having those problems, I highly recommend avoiding them. And then like, even if not, some of them don't really make that much sense to have for any specific reasons, so we could talk about that. I'd want to preface the whole conversation with that. So the focus is really going to be about metabolism and not like, well, yeah, spinach is fine, just like eat as much as you want. It's like, no, I would agree that if you're sensitive to oxalates, you probably wouldn't want to eat a large amount of spinach. So I think we want to start with that, because we're going to, like, when we start to get into the metabolism of this type of stuff, it's going to be a little bit of a different take.
Well, I think the dumping, right, is experienced by mostly carnivore dieters. And it's like there's a range of time that you see these people have run into oxalate problem issues. So, I think it's important with all the theories that are about a certain compound, like building up and reaching a certain threshold and then experiencing a symptom. It creates like a fear and a panic in people, especially if they think it's something that they've been eating for a really long time and now they have to like pay the price for that. So, yep. Providing some guidance and maybe presenting this other theory, right? And some strategies you can put into place to make sure, like, okay, you're not freaking out all the time about everything that you're eating. You have a reasonable idea of what's going on.
Yes.
So I'm excited to jump into things, because I know what you're going to share is I haven't really heard talked about in the whole sphere, you know, around oxalates and whatnot. So,
like, when we were preparing for these videos for this podcast, I was watching Sally Norton, I was watching Elliot Overton, I was watching Dr. Paul Saladino, Dr. Chafee, like seeing what is the perspective on oxalates. And like, you look in the comment section, people are just like, well, what do I eat? It's like, if you actually look at an oxalate food list, it's like what's considered medium, high, very high, and extremely high, like covers quite a bit of foods. So if you're worried about oxalates and you're worried about PUFA and you're worried about lectins and you're worried about processed foods and you're worried about dairy and like you like worrying about all these foods, you basically get to this point where there's nothing left to eat. And I think that's one of the things that actually drives people towards this, the carnivore camp or like a keto camp or something like this. Cause like, well, all these foods are just toxic. I don't know what I should eat. And there's a part of me that's like, yeah, there's some problems with some of these foods, but I don't think that everybody has a problem with every single one of these foods. There's like specific circumstances and some of these foods. Yeah. Like, are we going to sit here and argue that highly processed foods are a good idea or stuff like this? No. But it's just that there has to be more of an understanding of like, how could some of these foods be a problem for some people, not other people? And then why are people who are not eating any of these foods getting a problem? Are there tissues just releasing all these oxalates and having this dumping effect? Or is there something else? Is there more to the picture? Is there something else going on? And yeah, so that's what I want to get into so we can jump in.
And that first clip that we're going to look at here in a second from Sally does go over the like threshold and building up like a toxic thing. But maybe it'd be good to just give like a brief overview of like what is an oxalate and put that in the context for people. And then we can listen to see what Sally has to say.
Yeah, so oxalate is an acid that's an end product of metabolism in humans that can mix with, usually the biggest concern is with calcium in the body, to form a crystal. And so the calcium oxalate, which is now a crystal, is damaging to many tissues, can get lodged in the tissues, and is especially damaging to the kidney. The kidney is the main site of excretion, with the gut being the second site of excretion for oxalates, but the major site being the kidneys. And if you get a burdening or overload of oxalates, it can put pressure on the kidneys, but also you can actually get oxalate crystal formation inside the tissues. But the question is, like, why exactly and where exactly does it happen? Now, there are genetic disorders where your body just makes way too much oxalate because of errors in metabolism. Some of the enzymes don't function appropriately, and those are going to become important. We're going to talk about them specifically here. Not all the specifics of the genetic disorders, but the major one, primary hyperoxaluria, involves an enzyme, AGXT1. That will be helpful to talk about and explain some of what's going on. So the body makes oxalate. It comes in the diet. It has to be excreted largely through the kidney. If you get high amounts and it mixes with calcium, it can form crystals. And the crystals is basically like little shards of glass, essentially, that can be irritating to the tissues, especially the kidney, the vasculature. It can get lodged in the tissues to some extent. And also the oxalic acid itself triggers an inflammatory response and has negative effects on mitochondrial function and on tissue function in general. It is inherently problematic. Now, the body makes it, so it is able to actually process it, detoxify it, push it out in the urine. It's just in certain circumstances, the body can be overwhelmed to some extent by its excretion. So it's the amount that it can excrete at a period of time, or how much is being produced or taken in. These things will also be important to consider, and especially very important in the circumstances that we're going to discuss is the actual endogenous production. Because again, the intake, the consumption of oxalates has been the primary focus, but there hasn't been as much talk from what I've seen about endogenous production, which I think is actually one of the most important pieces to focus on here. So hopefully that gives like a clear enough rundown of oxalates, the general idea of their negative effects, and then that they can be produced by your body and you can take them in, and your kidney is the main place that's excreting them.
And now we can go take a look at what Sally has to say with her theory around oxalates and then building up in the tissues.
This is Sally with Dr. Anthony Chafee talking about oxalates.
You develop a bioaccumulation problem. We are building up a toxic store of oxalate in our tissues, thyroid glands, bone marrow, tendons, all over. And when you quit eating them, the body's like, oh, geez, it's about time. We can finally clean house. Like, your body's been waiting for this moment when you quit eating all these high oxalate foods, and it starts breaking down the deposits, and you're refilling your bloodstream and your kidneys and your urine and your body with mobilized oxalic acid. So you re-intoxifying yourself in the release process. I mean, your body's digging up toxic stores, like little waste barrels in your tissues, and sending them out on the roadways, which is your arteries and veins and capillaries, so that the kidneys can clear it out of your system. So this is like having like radioactive dump trucks with not covers on them, like spilling crap everywhere. Like, it can be very unpleasant, the whole process of this, what I call surgery without anesthetic, of getting rid of this toxic load that's been building up ever since your first peanut butter sandwich.
This clip sets the stage. There's a couple important pieces here that Sally discusses. So one, there's this idea that oxalates are being built up in toxic stores in the tissues from, I quote, your first peanut butter sandwich. So that's the first thing. And then the second idea is that once you stop eating oxalates, once you decrease your oxalate consumption, your tissues are like, oh, we don't have oxalates coming in, so we're going to start dumping the oxalates into your bloodstream so that your kidneys will actually excrete the oxalates. And then what she's saying is, as the oxalates are dumped into your bloodstream, they have a damaging effect on the body overall. But here's the problem. If your tissues And I guess before we even get there, so this is what is discussed on the carnivore diet when people talk about oxalate dumping. And so what they start to talk about is like, when I went carnivore, I got oxalate dumping symptoms because I decreased my oxalates because now I'm just eating meat and salt and basically like usually that's it, maybe eggs or some other animal foods, which usually meat and salt, which is very, very low oxalates. There's not really much oxalates at all. And so what people say is they get kidney pain, they get bladder pain, they get cloudy urine, they get diarrhea, skin irritation, which includes rashes, dandruff, joint pain, tendon pain, muscle pain, eye irritation, anxiety and depression, brain fog, electrolyte issues, cramps, headaches, sleep disturbances, and arrhythmia. So a lot of this within certain portions of the carnivore community are considered to be caused by oxalate dumping. And it's through this mechanism that Sally discusses. So she's saying, hey, if you go carnivore, like you're gonna lower your oxalate load, you're gonna start dumping oxalates, and you're gonna get all, like, she's not necessarily saying this. She mentioned some of these symptoms, but people in the carnivore community discuss these as being the symptoms. Now, this is a problem because a lot of things can cause these symptoms. So electrolyte issues can be caused like irrespective of oxalates. And that's the same thing for joint pain, muscle pain, eye irritation, anxiety, depression, brain fog, headaches, sleep disturbances, arrhythmias, et cetera. There could be a lot of reasons why that aren't specific to oxalates. Oxalates are proposed as a theory, but we haven't proven that it's just specifically oxalates. And because there's a lot of problems that we've talked about that can occur with the changes on the carnivore diet. So that's the first thing. That's the perspective to put it into the dumping syndrome, which again is typically seen on carnivore and low carb diets. These are the communities that experience it on average. The problem with this is if your tissues were already loaded with oxalates, you just have these big stores of oxalates, why don't you have symptoms beforehand?
Because the oxalates are supposed to be damaging to the tissues.
Yes, oxalic acid by itself is directly damaging to the tissues. So if you look into the research and you see the effects of oxalates on the body, so when we look at the negative effects of oxalates, they cause oxidative damage directly. They decrease antioxidant defense. They damage the mitochondria. They cause damage to the endoplasmic reticulum. They induce autophagy here, which is not a good thing, which is cell death. They induce cellular senescence. They cause fibrosis in the kidney, and they drive inflammation. So inherently, the oxalates are toxic, inflammatory, have a bunch of problems. So if your tissues were already loaded up on all of these oxalates, even beyond the research studies, the fundamental question I ask myself is, why aren't you already having all of these symptoms? If you're already loaded up and you have to dump and they're already in the tissues, why is this not happening? And keep in mind, both oxalic acid and the calcium oxalate crystals cause damage. So it's not like it has to crystallize first to be a problem. The crystals and the oxalate in certain concentrations are both problematic. So then you would think that if somebody is already loaded with this, they would already have problems. They would already be seeing the sleep disturbances, the skin problems, the like all of this type of stuff. The only thing that maybe would change would be the kidney pain and the bladder pain, because you're saying, okay, now you're excreting more oxalates in the urine. It's coming out in the urine, so the bladder's getting irritated, the kidney's getting irritated, et cetera. But then the joint pain and stuff should already be occurring. So why would it be getting worse? Why would, if the tissues are leaching it out, why would it necessarily be getting worse? This is where I'm starting to question the theory in and of itself, because if you're already loaded, you should have problems, right?
I think that Sally would say, right, that there are people who are consuming oxalates and have been for a long time and then are experiencing symptoms throughout that process. But then again, like you're pointing out here, the dumping is usually seen by carnivores who maybe prior like didn't necessarily have problems with oxalates. But then the time frame at which they can start experiencing the dumping or the supposed symptoms from oxalates is like 3 years in, you know, 6 months in, a week in, or something like that.
And it fluctuates too. That's the other thing, is they say that it fluctuates and it can take years. I watched a bunch of carnivores channels trying to see what they're saying. You could oxalate dump for years. If you are eating plant-based diet, you have so much stored oxalate. It fluctuates. Like some days, like I'll have oxalate dumping for months, and then like I'll have a couple days and I'll be fine, and then I'll come back. But the thing is like, you should, like, the thing is that these are enough of a problem. The symptoms that develop are enough of a problem on these diets that people have actually created a, like, oxalate dumping as a thing. It's known within these spheres that you can develop oxalate dumping. But that's the thing is, like, so you are developing new, technically you would be developing new symptoms or a worsening of symptoms that you didn't have before, or that you had before in a more mild version. And if you were excreting the oxalates into your bloodstream, then you would, and it was coming out in your urine, then you would assume that those symptoms should technically be improving, not be getting worse. And right. also, like, how much oxalate stores do you actually have in your body? Are you just like a crystalline statue of oxalates? Like, if that was the case, you would seriously be having issues even before you went on a diet. And people, the thing is, people are having issues, but like, that's why they're deciding to go on some of these diets. But the fact that we have oxalate dumping as a syndrome means that some of these symptoms are getting worse for people and or are new for people to the point that it has to be recognized as this is something that occurs. So that's why it's like, is this theory that when you release, like when you have low oxalate intake, that you just start releasing more? Again, it's typically associated with low carb diets. It's typically associated with carnivore, especially, which is going to be important. We'll get to that.
Yeah.
And so that's the thing. For me, I started to question, like, is it really dumping? Are you really just releasing it from your tissues? And then now you're having all of these problems because you're releasing it from your tissues. And then she goes on to talk about that there's a re-intoxification process.
Right.
But it's like, if you already have it in your tissues, you're already intoxified yeah. by the oxalates. So you should already be having the problems. It's not really logically making sense. You just dump and then, oh yeah, everything is like, you just get worse before you get better type of thing. And it goes in cycles and it lasts for years. That's where I think you have to start to be careful around saying, like, is this, because this is a theory, is this theory actually true? Is this theory legit? Is that the actual cause? Or is there something else going on? And I think the answer is there is something else going on. And it's not that you're just dumping from your tissues. I think that the oxalate production actually gets increased endogenously on a carnivore diet and a lower carbohydrate diet, depending on how it's set up.
Usually with the diet strategies that kind of harness in on one particular nutrient or component in a specific food, right, are associated with, oh, there's this time frame that you have to go to like detoxify and stuff. And that, I think, is a dangerous kind of pattern to get into, especially when you start extending out the detoxification phase like years and years. It's like kind of, you don't know if you're on the right track, right? You saw that with the vitamin A stuff. And I think you kind of see it with the oxalate stuff as well. But so you're saying that the low, like the carnivore and maybe low carb ketogenic state that people put themselves in, prime them for this oxalate dumping. And it's because of the endogenous production of oxalates in that state versus the intake and this like threshold that you hit over years in your life. And now you're experiencing the dumping symptoms from the tissues. It's more a metabolic process.
Yes, exactly. Because oxalate production is one of the major sources of oxalate in the body, like endogenous production by the liver. On a carnivore diet, you don't really have that much oxalate. You have almost zero oxalate coming in because you're not eating any plant foods. So you wouldn't be getting it. If you can rule out the diet, it's not going to really come in from the diet. So it's not coming from exogenous sources. This dumping idea doesn't really make sense logically. Like, there's a lot of things that would have to be explained to make that make sense logically. Even with that, like, it just doesn't seem to make sense because we know that oxalate causes problems by itself. So if it's already in the tissues, you should already be having the problems. It shouldn't be like just, oh, it's just coming out of my eyes now. It's just coming out of my skins now. It was already always there, but it wasn't causing a problem until I stopped having oxalates. And then now it decides to excrete itself through my skin or through my eyes or into my joints. That explanation doesn't really seem to make sense to me. So when you start to see that the body actually produces a large portion of oxalate, and depending on your diet, how much oxalate you're taking in, how much calcium you're taking is calcium will bind oxalate, and how much oxalate, like soluble oxalates you're getting, you may actually have the vast majority of your body, or the oxalate in your body, is being produced endogenously by your liver. And so then the next question becomes, what are the things that control endogenous production of oxalate? And this is where the story, the plot thickens, or the plot starts to become more interesting around this oxalate dumping syndrome and like the hidden stored oxalates. And to be fair, like, this is not to say that you don't actually get oxalate crystals in the tissues, because you can see oxalate crystals in the tissues. This is more to say is the dumping syndrome and the symptoms that people are having in these particular contexts actually because of this dumping, or is it because of something else? The whether you store crystals in the tissues to some extent, especially disease tissues, which we'll come back to in just a couple of minutes around when we talk about some of the metabolic stuff. What I want to describe the mechanism by why this occurs. So anybody who is concerned about oxalates or oxalate dumping, or who is like trying to figure out why this is happening to them on their low carb diets, they can, like, they have the hypothesis here, and they can start to understand what exactly I'm getting at here. So we have a paper here. The paper is titled "Glucagon Increases Urinary Oxalate Excretion in the Guinea Pig." So basically what they do is that they said here, said glucagon decreased hepatic alanine levels by 66%, lactate by 69%, and pyruvate by 73%, but glycolate and glyoxate levels were unaffected. This decrease in alanine would substantially lower the activity of alanine to glyoxylate aminotransferase activity. So that's the AGXT enzyme I talked about in vivo, and make more glyoxylate available for oxalate synthesis. The decrease in lactate and pyruvate concentration would stimulate the enzymatic conversion of glyoxylate to oxalate and may account for the increase in oxalate synthesis without an increase in glyoxylate concentration. These results demonstrate that hepatic oxalate synthesis is influenced by metabolic changes, and that alterations in hepatic alanine, lactate, and pyruvate concentrations may be important elements. The major area where oxalate is produced in the body is in the liver. And the major precursor to oxalate, besides vitamin C, which we'll talk about separately, is glyoxylate. And so we can see in this graphic here, you have glyoxylate, and you can see glyoxylate can be converted here to oxalate, etc. With that, the next thing is, well, what causes the production of glyoxylate? You have glyoxyl, which is not listed here, and then you also have glycolate. And the other thing you can keep in mind is the major sources really is going to be hydroxyproline and glyoxyl, and then glycolate's an intermediary. But what winds up happening is you also have the ability to detoxify glyoxylate. And in order to detoxify glyoxylate, you need to use this enzyme here, you see AGT. And in order to turn glyoxylate into glycine, which is an amino acid, a neurotransmitter, non-toxic, bunch of benefits for health, all this type of stuff, you need to actually have adequate amounts of alanine. And then you also need to have adequate amounts of pyruvate, because AGT will take glyoxylate, convert it to glycine, and then we'll take that, also have an enzyme where it takes alanine, converts it to pyruvate, and then has another reaction where it takes pyruvate and converts it to hydroxypyruvate, which eventually gets converted to D-glycerate. So essentially, when you have a low-carb diet, particularly a carnivore diet more than a keto diet, in a circumstance where you have a higher protein intake and you're really driving gluconeogenesis, which is what you would see more likely on a carnivore diet, which is why I think the oxalate dumping is more prevalent on a carnivore diet, the process of converting amino acids into glucose takes away the alanine, and it also depletes the lactate, and it also depletes the pyruvate, because these are being used and converted into glucose at the liver. And so then this enzyme AGT doesn't have enough alanine, doesn't have enough pyruvate to actually have the metabolic reaction occur. And then what happens is it cannot convert the glyoxylate to glycine. And so the glyoxylate gets converted to oxalate, because you have more oxalate laying around. Now, the next thing, I know this is like a little bit biochemistry-ish, but the next thing is you have this enzyme lactate dehydrogenase, which converts pyruvate to lactate. And what you see is that glyoxylate gets converted to oxalate through lactate dehydrogenase. So if you deplete pyruvate because you're running gluconeogenesis, or you have this glucagon, what they're showing here in the liver for the guinea pig is that the alanine decreased by 66%, lactate by 69%, and pyruvate by 73%. What winds up happening is now you leave more room for the lactate dehydrogenase enzyme to convert glyoxylate into oxalate. So you can't get your glyoxylate. You inhibit the ability to turn it into glycine, because AGT, the enzyme that is basically detoxifying the glyoxylate so it doesn't go to oxalate, it doesn't work because it doesn't have the substrate it needs. And then on top of that, the enzyme that converts glyoxylate into oxalate, now it has more availability. It has more spots open to take that glyoxylate and turn it into oxalate. So what you're seeing is the change in metabolism of the diet is increasing endogenous oxalate production. And that endogenous oxalate production is what I think is driving the symptoms for people who are sensitive people or susceptible people who are experiencing oxalate dumping on the carnivore diet. There's another mechanism that I want to talk about, but I know you probably have some questions you want to ask me about this. So
I'm doing my best to follow everything that's going on there. But my general takeaway, and I think the audience is probably going to relate a lot to this, is there's some process of of oxalate, and there's some production of oxalate in the liver processing system.
Yes.
And there's some deficiencies in enzymes in the liver that are maybe disrupting that process and causing causing things to go necessarily where they shouldn't go, I guess. there's a lot of characters here. But I guess, okay, so there's certain things that these enzymes need to move, precursors to oxalate going further down that path and more towards things like glycine and some of these other beneficial.
The easy way to summarize it.
Yeah.
I'm going to try my best to So oxalate is an end product, right? It gets converted, like you convert stuff to oxalate in the kidney, you pee it out via your kidney, right? The major precursor to oxalate is glyoxylate. There's vitamin C, but that's different. We'll talk about that. So the most circumstances, glyoxylate is going to increase your oxalate production. Now, glyoxylate is like the rate limiting thing. It's like whatever is controlling glyoxylate is adjusting oxalate production. And so you can either get rid of glyoxylate by turning it to glycine through that enzyme AGXT1, and actually primary hyperoxaluria, which is genetic disorder, is an error of metabolism involving AGXT1. So it's that enzyme. Basically, that enzyme is, I think it doesn't migrate to the peroxisomes, doesn't work. And so what winds up happening is you cannot take your glyoxylate and convert it into oxalate, or convert it into glycine, excuse me. Yes. So then what winds up happening is you build up glyoxylate and then you get really high oxalate. You get really high oxalate levels, which leads to kidney failure. And then you get oxalosis, where you have oxalates all over the body that deposit in the joints and tissues and cause all these problems. And so essentially that genetic disease is just blocking that enzyme. And basically the carnivore diet, at least in my hypothesis here, is that by having a really high protein intake that is increasing gluconeogenesis, because you don't have any carbs. You're just eating a crap ton of protein on the carnivore diet. Most times, a lot of people at least are. What winds up happening is that you are driving gluconeogenesis, and glucagon is shifting the metabolism around so that you can actually increase the amount of glyoxylate that is available to be converted into oxalate by lowering amino acids, lowering lactate, lowering pyruvate. So it's inhibiting the enzyme that detoxifies glyoxylate, and it's enabling the enzyme that turns glyoxylate into oxalate.
So you're getting hit in two ways there.
Exactly. And it's the liver is doing it.
So the enzyme doesn't have the tools that it needs to function necessarily because of the state that the carnivore diet is putting you into. And exactly. Therefore you get a buildup of the precursor that's needed to form oxalate. Instead, if the enzyme was working and had all the necessary tools to function, you would be converting it away from that precursor and into something beneficial like glycine.
Basically, the carnivore diet changes metabolism, so you can't detoxify glyoxylate, which is a precursor to oxalate. So you get a bunch of the precursor, which leads to the final product.
One question that I have, and maybe this is jumping back a little bit, is recommendations you hear from Elliot Overturn and Sally Norton when you're dealing with oxalate issues is to increase your intake of oxalate just a little bit. Like maybe have one square of dark chocolate or a little bit of nuts. And their theory behind that is that that will stop the dumping from the buildup in the tissues, and then you won't experience the quote unquote oxalate dumping. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that. I don't know if that works. I haven't really seen anybody say that that cured the oxalate dumping. I've just seen it recommended as a strategy.
Yeah. So that was the thing I was trying to find too, is I couldn't, I was looking at some forums, and I was looking at like Reddit and YouTube videos, and I couldn't find where people said like, hey, like this actually like completely eliminated my oxalate symptoms. So it was like, I see it recommended, but I also am not seeing like people like, yeah, like this completely got rid of my oxalate symptoms. So I'm not like that piece I haven't fully rectified with this model. So I don't know if it works to be 100%. And I'm not 100% sure like what would be the mechanism by taking in more oxalate would shift the, and because also they're not taking in that much oxalate, that much more oxalate overall, because it's just a very small amount they're recommending. And so I'm not, that piece I'm not 100% sure on. What I'm mainly trying to solve with this is that initial problem, like if your tissue's already loaded and you dump oxalates, why are you getting worse? Why are the symptoms getting worse? Why do they last for this long period of time? Why do they fluctuate up and down? And then also, why are you getting these symptoms on a diet that doesn't have any oxalates coming in? And that's where it's like, okay, I think it's related to this change in metabolism. So then we could say maybe something changes in metabolism when they use some of these other foods, if it is even solving that specific problem.
But similar to your experience, when I was looking at different forms or whatnot too, I was having a hard time finding people who said that their oxalate symptoms went away after they started introducing little bits of it. But it is like a top recommendation. So yeah, if anybody, I guess, has experience with that and they or oxalate dumping and they fixed it by intaking a little bit of oxalate, like please let us know in the comments below. That'd be an interesting kind of rabbit hole to go down to see why exactly that could help eliminate symptoms.
The goal here is to try to figure out why is this happening? Because the original theory doesn't seem to make 100% sense, at least to me. So that's why I'm thinking there has to be something else going on. And that's why it's like, I think it can be explained by the change in metabolism of oxalates with the diet driving the gluconeogenesis. There's actually another piece too that's really important to talk about is that, so what I mentioned before was that the major precursor to oxalate is glyoxylate, but the major precursors to glyoxylate are actually glyoxal and hydroxyproline.
High on the carnivore diet.
There's studies here where basically they give people high amounts of collagen or gelatin protein, which is very high in hydroxyproline, and it actually increases the amount of glyoxylate and also the amount of oxalate that people excrete in their urine. So I think you have a circumstance with high protein intake, not a lot of carb intake, and then so that will drive gluconeogenesis. It'll have an impact on lactate dehydrogenase, and then the gluconeogenesis will shut down AGXT to some extent and lead to a circumstance where you aren't detoxifying the glyoxal into glycine, and then you're actually enabling the conversion of glyoxal into oxalate because of lactate dehydrogenase and what's changing with metabolism. And then you can have an increased flow into glyoxylate from the high protein intake via high hydroxyproline consumption. So now you have, like, if you're on a carnivore diet and you're doing like beef and gelatin and bone broth and stuff like this, depending on how much you're getting, you could actually see a bump in your oxalate excretion and your glyoxylate levels just from that. And then the high meat intake itself can bump up the hydroxyproline content and then the gluconeogenesis and then the lack of carbs. So it's like you're setting the metabolic stage here to actually increase the production of oxalates. I do have a quote for everyone to share my work. Although the principal precursor of oxalate is believed to be glyoxylate, pathways in humans resulting in glyoxylate synthesis are not well defined. Hydroxyproline, a component amino acid of collagen, is a potential glyoxylate precursor. We have investigated the contribution of dietary hydroxyproline derived from gelatin to urinary oxalate and glycolate excretion. Response to ingestion of 30 grams, so not even that much, of gelatin or whey protein were compared on controlled oxalate diets. The time course metabolism of a 10-gram gelatin load was determined, as well as response to varying gelatin loads. Urinary glycolate excretion was 5.3-fold higher, so glycolate is a metabolite of glyoxylate, on the gelatin diet compared to the whey diet, and urinary oxalate excretion was 43% higher. Significant changes in plasma hydroxyproline and urinary oxalate and glycolate were observed with 5 and 10-gram gelatin loads, but not 1 and 2 gram loads. So even they saw a change in plasma hydroxyproline and urinary oxalate, even on 5 and 10 grams of gelatin. Extrapolation of these results to daily anticipated collagen turnover and hydroxyproline intake suggests that hydroxyproline metabolism contributes to 20 to 50% of glycolate excreted in urine and 5 to 20% of urinary oxalate derived from endogenous synthesis. So basically what they're showing here with this study is that even the gelatin or like high hydroxyproline intakes can increase oxalate excretion because it's a precursor to glyoxylate. So if you are flowing in a bunch of protein that has a lot of hydroxyproline content that from steak and from gelatin and collagen and bone broth and all this type of stuff, and it's getting converted to glyoxylate, and then you're upregulating gluconeogenesis because you don't have carbs and because you're eating tons of protein and you're not fully like your ketosis may be adjusted based on how much protein you're eating, then you can actually really drive oxalate production. I think in susceptible people, this may be the actual underlying cause for the oxalate dumping through these mechanisms, and maybe not so much as the actual dumping effect. So it's increased oxalate production, which would mean that the carnivore diet is actually causing the oxalate problems directly. It's not solving it, which is a very important thing because it changes the perspective pretty significantly because people are saying, oh, you just need to stay on this diet. You'll keep dumping oxalates. You'll clear out all your tissues. And what we're seeing here is, well, maybe you're actually increasing your production of oxalates at your body to a point that's driving these issues by themselves. So it's not a cure. It may actually be a problem. Even though, and that doesn't, to be fair, like that doesn't mean the diet's not solving other problems for people, but it may mean that the oxalate dumping issue that we're seeing is a unique feature of the metabolism of this specific dietary setup. And that's very important to delineate, like which thing is the cause. Is it dumping or is it increased production? That because if you're just going on the hypothesis, like 10 years down, 5 years, 4 years, 3 years, whatever down the line, that this is just because of oxalate dumping, but it's actually production, and you're making yourself, you could be potentially making yourself worse and not solving the oxalate problem. And that's why it's important to be like, you have a hypothesis, but we need to be clear on what the cause is. I'm not saying that I even know this to be the exact cause. What I'm trying to say is like, is there another thing that could be going on, and how could I explain this reasonably with research studies to say like, this is what I think is going on, or this is what may be going on, because the initial hypothesis has some flaws that don't seem to line up and make sense. Like there's some gaps that aren't making sense overall. And so that's basically the context here, or that's the whole purpose that we're talking about with this specific circumstance. And it'll become more important in when we start to talk about, we have the next clip, but I'll start to talk about other states with oxalate metabolism.
We can jump into the next clip, but before that, real quick, I just want to ask, with the gelatin and collagen and stuff, like, you're not saying that that's something that should be completely removed from the diet in general. It's just a contributing factor. It could be a contributing factor in a specific state, right?
Yeah. For somebody who like excretes it fine at the kidney, doesn't have any kidney damage or like severe metabolic dysfunction or genetic problems with oxalate metabolism, they may not have an issue dealing with it. It may not be that big of a deal. But if you have somebody who does, like smashing like 100 grams of collagen a day may not be a good idea for that person, because they may predispose themselves towards the oxalate kidney stones and things like this. And then if you're creating a dynamic with the carnivore diet where you're changing the metabolism that optimizes for oxalate production, and you're increasing the precursor to glyoxylate formation, which then can get converted to oxalate, then you may be putting yourself in a circumstance where you're predisposing yourself to oxalate problems and precipitating the joint pain and the skin issues and the bladder pain and the kidney issues and whatever else from the oxalates. So it's going to come down to that person's individual context. So for most people, it's fine. Like, I doubt collagen is the cause. But for people who are dealing with oxalate dumping on a carnivore diet, like, or who have issues in bone marrow metabolism and managing oxalates, then they may want to be careful with the bolus of collagen that they have, or they may want to put solutions in place to prevent that from being a problem. Does that make sense?
I mean, like with everything, I guess it just depends on a person's context and kind of the combination of things you're doing at the time. And so let's jump to the next one.
The next clip just picks up from where we left off before with Dr. Anthony Chafee and Sally Noren, because they continue to discuss certain pieces here.
People don't really realize that, you know, these toxins do build up. Say, well, you have it and it's just like your body clears it and gets rid of it. But it doesn't really. You know, a lot of these things do build up. So where do these things go? Is all your tissue, or is there a certain tissue that they really go in and cause more of a problem?
Well, you know, we're talking about the oxalates that come from your diet, which is the majority of oxalates that are in your body. Your liver actually makes some oxalate. It's a breakdown of vitamin C. Excessive amounts of vitamin C become oxalate in the body, and certain amino acids can break down into oxalate in the liver. So when you're eating them, you're eating both oxalate in a form of a crystal, because plants turn oxalic acid, which is this parent compound, into calcium oxalate crystals for the many purposes for their own use. So you're eating crystals and you're eating oxalic acid. And the oxalic acid starts going into your bloodstream from the stomach and the upper intestines. So the circulatory system there is now picking up oxalate. That hepatic circulation delivers everything that you absorb from the digestive tract straight to the liver.
The reason I wanted to point out this clip is because there's a couple things that are said here that I don't agree with. So one, Dr. Anthony Chafee made a statement saying that that your body doesn't clear oxalates, and your body does clear oxalates through the kidney. So like, most people will clear oxalates without too much issue. Obviously, there's a point at which it's too much, but your kidney is set up to actually clear oxalates. Like, if you have kidney disease, it may be different, but if your kidneys are functioning fine, you will clear oxalates. The second thing is that the majority of oxalates in your body don't necessarily come from your diet. It depends on your diet. So it's going to be a sliding scale based on how much oxalates you're eating. But regardless of that, you're still going to have a large proportion of oxalates being produced largely by the liver. So you can have the major source of oxalates actually be your liver. Like, greater than 50% of oxalate production can be your liver, even under like relatively normal circumstances, depending on what's coming in from the diet. And depending on if you have, like, again, if you have a genetic condition, like primary hyperoxaluria 1, 2, or 3, that's mainly endogenous production. And it depends on your diet. If you're not smashing tons of spinach, tons of kale, tons of beet, tons of rhubarb, tons of cocoa powder, things like this, maybe crap tons of sweet potato, you probably won't have, or there's some other foods, but like, you probably won't have that much oxalate. If your diet is like cooked squash and beef or chicken or seafood and rice, or even like white potatoes that have been boiled, your oxalate consumption, especially if you're having that meal with a glass of milk or cheese or something, is going to be very low because the calcium in the GI tract is going to bind it. The boiling is going to decrease the oxalate in the potatoes, and the other foods aren't high in oxalates. So it really depends on your diet, what you're eating. It's a huge blind spot, I think, to not recognize that endogenous oxalate production is a huge source of oxalates inside the body. Tying this into like a carnivore diet, on people who are dealing with oxalate dumping on a carnivore diet, they're not eating oxalates. So it cannot come from the diet. It has to come from somewhere else. And we already talked about the stored tissue. So that's what leads me to really think like this is something going on inside the liver. This is something going on with endogenous production. It's like for years and it fluctuates and you're still eating the same diet. Those are some holes that I think are really important that if they can't be rectified appropriately with that theory, then like, and then with say it's an actual endogenous production thing, then again, like people are trying to clear their oxalate issues, maybe making it worse with their endogenous production. So that's a really important thing. I wanted to show that because again, like these two are, or Sally is like the oxalate expert. And then Dr. Chafee is like the expert inside the carnivore sphere. And so if they're saying it's mostly dietary related and they're promoting that theory, but it's actually endogenous production, that could be a problem for people who are actually struggling with oxalate issues and trying to solve them. They're thinking they're solving them with the carnivore diet, and maybe it's causing these effects and these side effects. It's like a feature of that diet in these people because of the metabolic changes.
I just want to touch on a few of the things that she mentioned there and get your thoughts too. So one of the things she talked about was vitamin C. And I know I've heard on even the podcast with Paul, which the next clip is from, I don't think we have that specific clip, but they talk about vitamin C and not wanting to like mega dose it or get like really large amounts of it because that can contribute to the oxalate production. So what are your thoughts on that? Because I know even in like the last episode that we talked about with the gut health, one of the things we mentioned was putting like an acerola powder like fruit extract in the juices or something for polyphenols and everything like that. And I know I've used acerola, personally, and you do get really high vitamin C, like higher than the RDA on that. So is that something that you take into consider with the oxalate situation? Or
vitamin C is a precursor to oxalates.
Okay.
But directly, the vitamin C gets converted to dehydroasorbic acid, and the dehydroasorbate can then be degraded into oxalic acid, like spontaneously, like in solution, basically. It can become diketoglucanic acid, and then it will be converted into oxalic acid and erythrolose. So it can occur. If you do take higher doses, you can increase urinary oxalate excretion. The question is, in a lot of people, it's probably not going to be an issue. But if you are somebody who's predisposed to forming calcium oxalate stones, it can actually become an issue. The other thing, though, is a carnivore diet is not characterized by high vitamin C intakes.
True.
So the problem probably is not vitamin C on carnivore. I know that's not what Sally is saying, so I'm not commenting her. Vitamin C can convert to oxalates. We do have a study here. They say Traxer et al. Observed a 21.8% increase in urinary oxalate excretion in normal subjects receiving 2 grams of ascorbic acid on controlled diet and 34.4% increase in stone formers in the same diet. Now, just because you increase your oxalate excretion doesn't mean it's a problem. Because the oxalate will, if you have a high citrate concentration in your urine, then the citrate will actually minimize the oxalate stone formation. You'll just pass the oxalates out in your urine. And also the question is like, are you reaching a threshold high enough to create a problem with oxalates if you just have a 21.8% increase in oxalate excretion? And it may not actually be enough. So because there's a lot of people who take vitamin C supplements have no like oxalate issues. So if you don't have you're not getting calcium oxalate stones, I think taking a reasonable amount of vitamin C on a regular basis, again, I'm typically shooting for like 500 milligrams per day for people who don't have a specific higher need and don't have calcium oxalate stones, like kidney stones, I think it will probably be okay. But when you start like doing like 4 grams, 5 grams, 6 grams, 7 grams, 8 grams, like you will see a bump in oxalate production in the body through the metabolism of vitamin C to oxalate. So that is something to be concerned about if you are somebody who forms calcium oxalate kidney stones.
The other component that I wanted to touch on quickly was around the gut health and like oxalate absorption through the large intestine. Again, the episode that we did last episode was about the carnivore diet and its effect on the gut.
Yes.
Now I know we're not talking about major amounts of oxalate being absorbed through the gut, right? Because you're not taking in any oxalate. Yep. But how much of a concern is it that oxalate is like being absorbed like through the large intestine?
In certain populations, it's a huge concern. So if you have Crohn's disease and you have, or you have like severe fat malabsorption, you can actually get like hyperoxaluria. You can get a high amount of oxalates circulating because of the uptake through the gut. And so the basically what happens is when you get Crohn's or ulcerative colitis or diseases like this, the gut becomes permeable to the calcium oxalate, and it can just, you'll absorb much more oxalate, not even just calcium oxalate, but oxalic acid and oxalates overall across the gut lining. It stops being such a good barrier. And then you can get, depending on what you're eating, it can really cause problems for these types of people. And then fat malabsorption is a big one as well. So this actually ties into the carnivore diet, so we'll get into that in a sec. But fat malabsorption is a big one, because if you aren't absorbing your fats, the fats are mixing with calcium in the gut, and then the calcium can't bind the oxalic acid from your diet, and then it leaves it free for you to absorb it. So fat malabsorption, gut inflammation, it directly lead to increased oxalate absorption. And also, if you have dysbiosis in the gut, that can lead to higher oxalate levels, because the bacteria in the gut, like lactobacillus bifidobacteria specific species, and also oxalobacter, degrade oxalates. And so if oxalobacter induces different transporters in the intestines, you have the SLC26 transporter in the small intestine secretes oxalates into the gut. So that's another way that you can actually get rid of your oxalates is through the gut, through that secretion in the small intestine. And then in the large intestine, that's the transporter that helps absorb oxalates. So oxalobacter induces the secretion of oxalates into the small intestine, obviously so that they can use it as an energy source. That's the hypothesis. So if you have gut dysbiosis, which carnivore can drive fat malabsorption for some people, carnivore can drive gut dysbiosis for some people, and some people, not everybody, it can drive gut inflammation, whereas other people can improve gut inflammation. And that's very person specific, depending on what's going on. So in that, the carnivore diet can drive issues in the gut that can also alter metabolism of oxalate, but it's less of a problem in the carnivore setup, again, because you have somebody who is not really eating that much oxalates, so like they're not really going to get a lot coming in. The major problem, I think, is production at the liver still with the carnivore diet. Now, if you have a paleo diet and it's like a keto paleo diet, and then you are like, you're eating really high fat, like tons of butter, tons of ghee, tallow, stuff like this, and you have fat malabsorption from, you're getting the runs, or you're having very high protein, high meat, plus the high fat setup, and it's causing dysbiosis for you, and then you're also eating a bunch of spinach and kale, well, then you may actually create a problem for yourself. So, or if you have Crohn's disease or SIBO or IBS, or irritable bowel disease, so ulcerative colitis, if you have these types of things, and then you try to eat high oxalate foods, that in itself may cause a problem. Or if you have a low calcium intake in your diet, which low carb diets tend to have, because they will eschew dairy to some extent, particularly like milk sources or stuff like this, particularly the paleo-esque setup tends to eschew dairy except for butter. And so these types of things can shift it as well. So these are all things to keep in mind, like fat malabsorption, intestinal irritation, gut dysbiosis, calcium intake. These are all really important for managing hyperoxaluria, at least inside the gut.
If you were one of those keto or paleo people that was experiencing symptoms and you're doing all the fat and everything like that, it would be kind of hard, right, to pinpoint that exactly and just be like, it must be the oxalates. So it's like, it's something you're doing with your overall state, right? That's maybe predisposing you to be more sensitive to the oxalates, which I guess would be a working theory that you could try to parse out. But ultimately, the way you go about it isn't like excluding all oxalates, right? At that point, it would be like, I got to change something so I'm not fat malabsorbing, or I don't have gut dysbiosis, right? And then I could probably even eat a little bit of like dark chocolate or whatever oxalate containing, you know, food in a quantity that isn't too much, right?
This full understanding is important, is because if you decide that you want to minimize oxalates, right? So say you aren't going to have anything that's high in oxalates. The amount of foods, I'm going to share my screen here. The amount of foods that you would have to actually minimize. There's a list. This is from lowoxalate.info. They have a food list. So when we get to high oxalate point, so it starts here at amaranth. And so we have amaranth, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, chili peppers, chocolate, cinnamon, collard greens, currants, date sugar, dates, dewberries, gooseberries, kidney beans, lemon peel, lime peel, orange peel, oranges, oregano, pepper, persimmons, pistachio, raspberries, tomato, almonds, black beans, buckwheat, carrots, chard, chocolate, like figs. It just keeps going. Like it, you can see it, like it's a lot of foods. If you're going to avoid oxalates, and then you're also going to try to avoid, you know, because Sally Norton says avoid oxalates and Dr. Gundry says avoid lectins. And, you know, I talk about like how I don't tolerate dairy and the paleo people says you can't have any grains. And then you like, you can't also can't have any carbs. It's like, then it's like, yeah, like, of course I'm going carnivore because it's like, that's the only thing that's left. And so that's why I think it's important to bring nuance to the conversation and understand like, when are oxalates actually a problem in your individual context? Because for me, I don't have a massive issue with oxalates. I have issues with other things. Like I don't do well with dairy, but oxalates aren't my like primary concern where I'm having all this joint pain and rashes and whatever else from the foods that I'm eating that are would be indicative of oxalate problems. I never had kidney stones or things like this, knock on wood, but I've never had these types of things. I have other issues that I would deal with based on my personal context, like what's going on with my health, what's going on with my predisposition, things like this. So it's important to start to dial in what is specific to you. Like, where is your specific problem? For somebody, they may have an issue with oxalates. For somebody, it may be dairy. For some people, it may be grains or starches or things like this, and start to hone in so that you're not just avoiding everything altogether and getting stuck in carnivore. Because then, as we talked about, carnivore has its own problems from a gut perspective, from a hormonal perspective, even though it eliminates other problems. So we're trying to figure out like what's the best setup for you based on your context, and trying to minimize problems while maximize like outcomes. And we're trying to use multiple strategies simultaneously instead of like, let's just eliminate everything. And it's like, well, I eliminate everything, I feel a little better, but now I have oxalate dumping and I can't sleep at night and whatever else. So that's why I think this becomes important. It's like, are all oxalate foods a problem? No. The major thing is which foods are very high in oxalates. So there are certain foods that are very high. Do they have a high soluble oxalate content, which is important because the soluble ones are the ones you're going to be absorbed. And then do you have dysbiosis? Do you have gut inflammation? What is your calcium intake when you're having calcium, magnesium intake when you have those foods? Because it will bind with that. How much citrate do you have on a regular basis? What's the kidney's normal capacity to actually detoxify oxalate? And so you have to take multiple factors into consideration. And it's like, okay, well, maybe the high foods aren't that bad, but the very high and like extremely high foods may be a problem. So, and then to be fair, like, Sally's book is about how certain superfoods are problematic from an oxalate perspective. And it's like, that is true. Like, people want to sit here and say spinach is this massive superfood because it's super high in all these nutrients and minerals and calcium. But the actual absorption of the calcium from spinach is not very good because of its oxalate content. And then if you want to minimize the oxalate content of the spinach, you got to boil it, which then you're going to decrease the calcium in the calcium levels and other mineral levels and some of the vitamins that were super high in spinach from the jump.
Yes.
So you're like, you get into the circumstance where, well, is it really this superfood? Because I have to do all this stuff that minimizes what made it a superfood on paper. And that's the same thing with legumes, beans, grains, and things like this that are difficult to digest and have some of these components. And so that these are important things to consider to get a full picture on an individual food, because every food has pros and cons. And some foods are going to be more pro for you and more con for you. And you need to understand the context for that. It doesn't have to be this difficult either, but if we're going to get into these types of conversations, it's important to actually like get into the nitty gritty of this stuff.
You mentioned calcium intake, and then you mentioned soluble oxalate content versus insoluble. Is that what you said?
Yeah, so
there's
soluble and insoluble. Soluble tends to be better absorbed. Insoluble, not as well absorbed. So you can have foods that are typically high in, that can be higher in oxalates, but most of it's insoluble. Like a large portion of fruits may have oxalates, but they're insoluble, so they're not really as well absorbed. And then say you're having calcium with that meal, that's going to further decrease that absorption. If you have magnesium with that meal, it's going to further decrease that absorption. And then also, if you have citrate, so say you have a glass of orange juice with your oxalates, the citrate, so say you have orange juice and a little calcium in your orange juice and a little magnesium in your orange juice, while you're having like your dark chocolate, you're not going to absorb all of those oxalates. You're going to drastically decrease the oxalates that you absorb, and you're going to decrease the formation of oxalate stones because the citrate's going to impair the oxalate formation, and then the calcium magnesium is going to impair the absorption. So these are really important things to consider when you are actually determining, is this oxalate going to be a super problem for me?
I mean, I have a lot of dark chocolate with juice and calcium and magnesium, so I must be okay.
Yeah, you're good to go.
I think that's a relief. That's a relief for the audience. So whenever you go to smash your chocolate bar before bed, just have some coral calcium with it as well.
Yeah, just get some or if you tolerate milk, like put your cocoa powder in some milk. Well, and there you go.
No. You guys aren't allowed to do that because I don't drink milk. So, do you want to jump into the last clip that we have here with Paul and Sally?
This is a good one because it ties into the next piece that I thought was really important here. Dr. Paul Saladino had Sally Norton on the podcast to actually discuss oxalates, and he brought up a really interesting point. He wasn't talking about some of the other enzymes, but he's talking specifically about some of the metabolic stuff. So I wanted to show this so we could talk about how metabolism is directly involved with the oxalate production in the body.
Oxalates can then inhibit the or sort of decrease the replenishment of glycogen in the muscles. So do you think that a ketogenic diet in some ways could be worse for oxalates if LDH is going up and that's making more oxalates?
Well, and other things that the oxidative damage that oxalate causes also elevates LDH. And so the oxidative stress of being poisoned with oxalates, and of course the liver is a key player here because the liver is where a lot of this oxalate is produced. And the liver is the first organ that has been taking a hit after every pile of fries, after every almond, whatever, after every spinach quiche. The liver gets 100% of the oxalates you absorb. And the liver is using up glutathione and having inflammatory stress during those periods of time. And so is the rest of the body, the vascular system, the immune cells. And that's also increasing this LDH enzyme, which increases oxalate production, but so does the inflammation themselves.
This is something that's important to talk about. Not just LDH, we'll get into the details here. But essentially, metabolic states control oxalate production. And we talked about LDH already. So if you're on a low carb diet and also if gluconeogenesis is bumped up, as we talked about, you can leave more room open in LDH because it doesn't have as much pyruvate to convert into lactate, where you actually will increase your LDH amount, which will increase the conversion again of glyoxylate into oxalate. But the other thing is, in order to metabolize glyoxylate, you actually need to have the cell you need to have the cell in a certain state. And so you have glyoxylate here, which can be converted to oxalate through NAD+, or as we see here, it can be converted into glycine and it requires alanine, or it can be converted into glycolate, which requires NADPH. So depending on what's going on in the cell will depend on how the things get metabolized, which is an extremely important point. This brings me to something that's not really talked about very much. The major precursor, besides hydroxyproline, to glyoxylate is glyoxyl. And the thing about glyoxyl is an aldehyde, and it's basically produced when you have like lipid peroxidation or problems with metabolic function and things like this. And so I have a quote here. They say, our research today indicate that of these potential sources, hydroxyproline makes a modest contribution, 5 to 10%, and the majority of others provide negligible amounts. We have found, however, by incubating a variety of 2-carbon molecules with hepatocytes, that glyoxyl is a prominent source of glyoxylate. We hypothesize that glyoxyl is one of the most important sources of endogenous oxalate synthesis in humans and possibly other organisms, and is one that has been overlooked to date. Mounting evidence is also suggesting that both glyoxyl production and oxalate synthesis can be associated with oxidative stress. So the glyoxyl is produced in circumstances where you're having issues with oxidizing carbohydrate. You're having issues with lipid peroxidation. You're having issues of protein glycation. So you see high amounts of glyoxyl in diabetics. You see high amounts of glyoxyl in people who have obesity or chronic kidney disease or cancer or AIDS or things like this, like high oxidative stress states. You're seeing high amounts of glyoxyl, and also one of the major sources of glyoxyl is polyunsaturated fatty acids that have been peroxidized, that have been destroyed. So if you have a state, altered metabolic state, a negative metabolic state, like an unhealthy state, not keto, not carnivore, but if you generally have metabolic syndrome-esque components, you can actually increase your glyoxyl levels. And then glyoxyl can be converted into glyoxylate, which can be converted to oxalate. So this is a supporting piece to the idea that metabolism is one of the major sources. Endogenous production and shifts in metabolism is one of the major sources of oxalate production. And so what they say here, So glyoxal is an alpha oxoaldehyde and is often grouped with two similar alpha oxoaldehydes, methylglyoxal and 3-deoxyglucosone. All three compounds are products of various metabolic and oxidative reactions and are capable of causing cellular damage and apoptosis, so cell death. They are also involved in the formation of advanced glycation end products, which have been linked to long-term sequelae of chronic diseases such as diabetes, retinopathy, neuropathy, and nephropathy, so kidney issues, nerve issues, and then issues with the eyes. So they say here, they say, although sugars are often regarded as the main source, lipid peroxidation is also a potentially important source of glyoxal. Three general steps occur during auto-oxidation of lipid molecules, initiation, propagation, and termination. In this case, initiation occurs when polyunsaturated fatty acids such as linoleic and linolenic acid undergo non-enzymatic lipid peroxidation. The resultant product is a hydroperoxide, which then degrade into a variety of oxidation products, including glyoxal. Glyoxal has been identified among auto-oxidation products of linoleic and linolenic acid and has been detected in ischemic, so porcine heart tissue, so pig hearts that had damage from lack of blood flow. I say glyoxal conversion to glycolate requires glutathione. So if you don't have adequate glutathione as an antioxidant, you won't convert to glycolate. And they say in situations where glutathione is depleted, as might occur with oxidative stress, other enzymes such as aldehyde reductase, aldose reductase, carbonyl reductase, aldehyde dehydrogenase, 2-oxoaldehyde dehydrogenase may be involved in the metabolism of glyoxal. So basically the glyoxal, as we see here, if you don't have glutathione over here, it doesn't get converted to glycolate. It gets converted to glyoxylate, which can then be converted into oxalate. So you have a circumstance where basically if you have poor metabolism, you can increase glyoxal, which can then increase glyoxylate and then increase oxalate. And so they say here, there's both inferential and direct evidence that glyoxal is involved in endogenous oxalate synthesis. Inferential evidence provided by studies of diabetics. They have higher plasma glyoxal levels than controls, perhaps due to increased lipid peroxidation and protein glycation, as well as increased urinary oxalate excretion. Diabetics also have a higher risk of kidney stone formation. So what we're basically seeing is that if you have metabolic dysfunction, you can actually increase your oxalate kidney stones. So this would further support the idea that changes in metabolism are potentially driving the oxalate dumping syndrome, and endogenous oxalate production is something that's extremely important to consider when you are trying to understand why you may be dealing with issues with oxalates, because we already know the dietary stuff. We know what to avoid. We can talk about the things to manage it. But the one thing that we don't see talked about in the oxalate sphere quite as much, at least from what I could see when we were going through this, is that there's not so much talk about the endogenous production of oxalates and how metabolism is changing that and leading to the overall problems.
I mean, what you do see, right, for the recommendations is kind of what we talked about earlier. Like, oh, well, Sally's not recommending like go completely carnivore. But if you do go carnivore, you're experiencing dumping, maybe adding in a little bit of oxalate to sort of reduce the dumping is kind of the theory that's promoted. But then again, we had a hard time maybe finding people that worked for. I'm not saying it doesn't. And if it did work for you, like, let us know. But
please let us know and we'll dive into it further.
But yeah, you don't hear necessarily that maybe there's something with the metabolic state the carnivore diet is putting you into. I mean, Paul's kind of alluding with the ketogenic diet to something along those lines. So,
yep.
So yeah. And then there was one other thing that you mentioned there. So the dumping, right? Do people experience dumping when in a situation like that you just kind of described, like where they're just in a terrible metabolic state, they don't really have dumping going on, right? But they could see like formation of kidney stones. Yeah. Okay. So yep. That's what it is. So it's like you could get calcium oxalate kidney stones.
Yes.
With just a poor metabolic state. And this kind of is like saying, just like with everything, PUFA is playing a rather large role in how that could be occurring, right?
So they said lipid peroxidation, basically DNA damage and protein glycation, which are, and how it's occurring is basically like metabolism being broken, not being able to take carbohydrate and oxidize it effectively, not being able to take fats and oxidize them effectively, having a lot of reactive oxygen species stress. This state can lead to increased production of glyoxal by changing what's going on with enzymes and by leading to general formation because of like what's going on with those different reactions. On top of that, if your tissues are loaded with polyunsaturated fatty acids, you particularly like linoleic acid and things like this, you are basically sitting on dynamite. So when like you may be okay by itself when you don't have this like this spark, like the spark going off. But once the fuse is lit and you're sitting on that pile of dynamite, when the problems start happening and you're loaded with polyunsaturated fatty acids, now you're going to, you can start producing a lot of, like you start getting the lipid peroxidation, which produces all this glyoxyl. And in the glyoxyl, another way it could cause a problem is can be converted to the oxalate. So it gets glyoxyl to glyoxylate to oxalate. And what also is changing that is if you don't have good glutathione status, if you don't have good antioxidant status,
right,
then what winds up, you'll shift towards glyoxylate versus going to glycolate, which can be converted into other components.
And if I understand that correctly, it's because the glutathione is being used up
in the reaction.
Okay. Okay. I see.
So the glutathione is being used up in that enzymatic reaction to convert the glyoxyl into the glycolate, but it's also helping to prevent the lipid peroxidation and the protein glycation and the DNA damage and things like this that are involved in the advanced glycation end product production, the AGES production, which is glyoxyl, methglyoxyl, and then it was the deoxyglucosone. So the general state is extremely important to understand. When you have a diabetic metabolic syndrome, you know, whatever the deal is, chronic kidney disease, all type of stuff, we have all this tissue damage going on, you're loaded up on polyunsaturated fats, you can increase glyoxyl, which can then also the state will shift it towards oxalate. If you are running a carnivore diet or like very high protein intake, you have a lot of gluconeogenesis going on, and it has a good hydroxyproline content, all this type of stuff, you're creating a unique circumstance that allows you to potentially increase glyoxylate production and then potentially shift enzymatic regulation so that you take that glyoxylate and convert it to oxalate through lactate dehydrogenase instead of detoxifying the glyoxylate to glycine through the AGXT1, that enzyme that's detoxifying. So what I'm using this here, because it's interesting to see that also metabolic dysfunction causes issues with oxalate production through glyoxyl, but it's also support to the general theory that endogenous production may be the main driver in oxalate dumping symptoms that people are experiencing on these specific diets through the change in enzymatic regulation, because we already see that in disease states.
Yeah, well, that's the interesting point too that you brought up earlier about the medications and the AGXT1 or something like that.
Yeah.
And blocking those enzymes that are needed for oxalate production is actually a treatment, right?
There's different medications they have now. So the two medications they have are lumasirin and nidocirin. They're drugs. They're like being tested, but they block lactate dehydrogenase and they block another enzyme called glycolate oxidase, which blocking lactate dehydrogenase decreases you can't basically convert glyoxylate into oxalate. And then glycolate oxidase doesn't allow for the production of glyoxylate. So these types of things are leading to change, like they're blocking those enzymes. So, and then basically those are treatments for primary hyperoxaluria, like the genetic diseases is what those enzymes are being used for. And just the glyoxylate can be converted to oxalate through the glyoxylate oxidase. So that's just a correction there, or glycolate oxidase. So these are things to keep in mind that metabolism is the central piece here. And I think in these particular circumstances, it doesn't mean that like eating tons of oxalates is necessarily good or that oxalates are a good thing. I still think they're problematic, but now we have more like solutions that we can get into around how to actually manage what is specifically going on in these states. And like for carnivore, it's like, maybe don't eat crap tons of protein without any carbs and shift this metabolism in that direction.
And there's a ton of other reasons that we'll get into with future podcasts and even podcasts that we did the last one that got as to why not to do carnivore too. But I think it's just helpful for people who are constantly searching the web and listening to different podcasters and doctors and whatnot in the sphere to take a look at the bigger picture, right? And not get so bogged down in the newest kind of nutrient or plant compound that's being demonized like that, you know, year or week and stuff, and be able to decide like, okay, how do I go about this in an intelligent way? Like, how do I kind of remove, like take a step back, right? And see like how the metabolic state is affecting things. And I think we did a good job like adding that as a piece of the discussion. And hopefully, I mean, if Sally wants to come on in the future, that'd be great too, to kind of discuss the theory and work through things together.
The big thing is that we need to determine for people who are experiencing oxalate dumping, is it through increased endogenous production,
right,
or is it because of the dumping effect? And I think that's extremely important. And also I think under like the context here is super important. There's two other things I just wanted to touch on that aren't like here in the clips, but not having adequate thiamine and B6, vitamin B6, can also lead to increased oxalate production because B6 is a cofactor for the AGXT enzyme. And then thiamine is involved in the degradation of glyoxylate, or necessarily the metabolism of glyoxylate away from oxalate through alpha-ketoglutarate carboligase. So there's these different enzymes that thiamine is a cofactor for, and that vitamin B6 are a cofactor for, that can actually help to minimize oxalate production or create oxalate production if you have deficiencies of those. So just as takeaways for people, if you're dealing with oxalate issues in general, number one, of course, I agree with Sally, like avoid really high oxalate foods. Like you're not, like if you have issues, then I don't think smashing spinach is a good idea, just as an example. And there's, I reference that list that you can check out for the high oxalate food. So it's the lowoxalate.info/food. The next one is that you want to make sure that your nutrient status is dialed in, vitamin B6 and also thiamine. Another one is if you're experiencing oxalate dumping on a carnivore diet, maybe you don't want to be in a carnivore diet. that'll be like, maybe we want to have some carbohydrates.
You probably move that one up the list.
Yeah, you want to bring the protein intake down a little bit so you're not driving gluconeogenesis. Then making sure you have adequate citrate consumption is helpful to prevent stone formation in tissues in the kidney, because the citrate directly prevents the stone formation. Having adequate calcium in the diet can also help you to avoid actually absorbing those oxalates, because the oxalates will mix with the calcium. Magnesium is another option. You probably don't want to be dosing really high amounts of vitamin C. That could be highly problematic if you have metabolic dysfunction. So if you are a type 2 diabetic who is going on a carnivore diet to manage your metabolic dysfunction, and you're starting to get oxalate dumping, you could be in a circumstance where you are actually like really primed for oxalate issues because you have potentially increased glyoxal production, and then now you're really forcing gluconeogenesis because the diet is like really high protein, low carb, you know, depending on how you set up diet, moderate or high fat intake. So be careful of that. And then also you have a circumstance where excess collagen intake could be a problem there. Not necessarily because glycine. Glycine is not really a large contributor here. It's mostly because of hydroxyproline. So those would be the key takeaways, and obviously adequate fluid intake and things like this, that I would actually recommend to help deal with specific oxalate issues instead of just avoid the foods. It's like, there's a lot of things that can be done, but I think fundamentally in the carnivore dumping setup, I'm skeptical that you're just pulling it from your tissues and that's creating issues. I think what's really happening is that you are increasing endogenous production because of changes in the metabolism. And I laid out the theory here, and then please let us know if eating oxalates fixes it, and then we can try to figure out what shifts. Maybe it changes the metabolism in some way, and then we can go from there.
Yeah, and there will be more videos coming out about oxalates in the future.
Yeah, I'm going to break down these mechanisms further in like individual videos talking about oxalates, showing the enzymatic pathways for the different components that I discussed here.
Okay, awesome. That will be helpful for everybody going forward. And so before we wrap up here, Mike, where can everyone find you?
They can find me here on Mike Fave YouTube channel, and they can also find me at my website, mikefave.com. What about you, Ethan?
They can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Ethan_Wright7, and then here on the Mike Fave podcast next week.